Hello and welcome back to Wealthwise, the financial planning podcast from Aberdeen. As you know, my name is Fraser Kerr, Regional Director here at Aberdeen Financial Planning. And in this series, we aim to bring you the conversations and the collective insights that help you achieve more every day. Today, we are focusing on the MyFolio fund range. And as we are recording this episode from a rather bleak and miserable One George Street head office, it is with real excitement that I'm joined by two incredible guests who have made the trip from London to be here today. Justin Jones, MyFolio Senior Investment Manager.
Good morning.
And Daniel Reynolds, Investment Manager alongside Justin and the MyFolio team.
Hello.
For a brief background on those who are unfamiliar, the MyFolio investment range is a long-standing cornerstone here at Aberdeen. It was a pioneering fund range adhering to quite clear management guidelines and to those attitude to risk principles, from the most cautious all the way to the most adventurous of investors. It forms a real foundation of Aberdeen Financial Planning's centralised investments that we offer our clients. So it's great to be in this position with them joining us here on Wealthwise today. Before we come on to MyFolio, the outlook, it'd be great to hear a bit more around the why of you as individuals. How do you find yourselves sitting in the chair today, and why is it that you do what you do, Justin?
Okay. Yeah, so look, I guess stepping back, I've actually been involved in financial services for 30 years at the end of this year, which makes me feel very old indeed. But look, I think going back, certainly when I was at school, I didn't have any idea what a fund manager even was. But I've always been interested in buying company shares, and my parents got me into that when we were the privatisations of the Thatcher years in the early 80s. So I took a keen interest in that from the very start. At college, I studied economics, and I really embraced that. I still read The Economist every weekend. I'm quite nerdy on some of that stuff. So that was kind of maybe two natural kind of feathers in that cap that would maybe have led me here. But my early career in 1994, when I started, was actually more in the corporate banking side. My role was quite tech focused, so running databases, talking to corporates around debts and lending. And I really kind of fell into asset management in 2001 when I moved across to Credit Suisse.
Working at that time must have been particularly interesting as well, with the financial crisis. I mean, coming through that must have been quite an experience.
Yeah, that was certainly an interesting few couple of years. And then we straight after that, we had the Eurozone debt crisis. So you have to learn how to cope with those things.
Makes you a bit more resilient.
Absolutely. May you live in interesting times, someone once said, is smarter than me. From there, from 2007, we've been involved in running funds of different varieties and colours. Aberdeen acquired us from Credit Suisse in 2009, and here I am.
Yeah. And Dan, your background's slightly different to Justin's. I suppose it's less traditional in terms of you wouldn't always have that sort of one eye on the prize with regards to getting into fund management, a bit more akin to the own guys. And you've actually worked with a few of our colleagues on the Aberdeen financial planning side. How is it you've found yourself in this position as well?
Well, I've always been more of a math geek than someone who did other subjects like history or English, as my teachers would confirm. I actually went to do electronic engineering at university, despite my teacher's advice. And it was true that I really liked maths, but perhaps less so the physics side of that. So when I left university, I really didn't want to do that. But I really liked the maths, I really liked the learning, and I really wanted to do something where I could go and chat to people and meet people. And so when a kind gentleman in 1997 gave me the opportunity to start as a financial advisor. Felt like it ticked the boxes. Yeah. I was basically going out and seeing people, chatting about it, and needed to learn really quickly about what I was doing.
Yeah, the technical side of it was still there underpinning it.
Exactly. So I took all the exams under the sun, managed to get an opportunity at Standard Life in 2000, which is when I joined here.
Oh, brilliant.
Really enjoyed continuing to learn over that period, I suppose. Yeah. And then through getting immersed in not just the tax side and the advisory side, but also the investment side, gradually grew more and more interested in that. The maths geekiness came out. I actually did a maths degree during that time, management certificate, to get a bit more knowledge about the investments.
Yeah.
And then in 2010, when MyFolio launched, or worked very closely with the MyFolio team back then, and helped my clients at the time understand the benefits of MyFolio, move into that, and we use the Wrap platform, etc. And then I pestered the head of the team for a job, and he said, "No, you're not ready." And so I carried on pestering him and carried on working. And then in 2013, I managed to join the team as a junior analyst.
It's quite a big decision going from that world that you were known and very senior in, going to that role of a junior analyst. I mean, very, you know, bold and brave decision for you to make at that time.
Those are the polite words for it.
Your wife must have been happy.
I did feel like I knew my stuff, and that was really nice. And I'm really glad that I still have that foundation.
Yeah.
And it's really good. But I'm a bit of a detail geek, and I really wanted to drill down into how it all works, like the underlying funds. So, crossed over and covered a number of asset classes since. And here we are today, I suppose.
I think you probably say there's many things to focus on, but what do you think is the most important thing for yourselves to kind of focus on, your key tenets that you always would come back to?
It's got to be the strategic asset allocation. Justin and I run the ranges that predominantly use passive underlying funds, but we certainly don't consider our funds to be passive. But the strategic asset allocation is applied with the same process across all of the MyFolio range, and that's really important.
What is that, Dan? What is the strategic asset allocation, if you were to summarize it?
So it is to build the blend of the available things we can invest in in the best way and the most suitable way for the client, depending on their view of risk.
Yeah.
So if you think of what's available in the market,
it's what you're taking off the shelf to build the basket to move it forward.
So shares, i.e. US, Europe, UK, etc., emerging markets, bonds, which are like loans to companies, corporate bonds, government bonds, property, cash. And so you never know which of those is going to do best. You certainly don't know which is going to do best over the next year. We use long-term expected returns based on what's happened in the past, how these investments will move against each other, to build a portfolio which blends all of those to deliver the pattern of returns, i.e. how bumpy the road will be, if you like, to make sure those clients are always getting what they expect. So it's blending those different asset classes, those different types of investment together to give a solid package.
Even over my time, I've seen this real shift as well. And I think a great example of that would be sustainable investments. And there's almost like this change in the zeitgeist where it became very prominent. That ethical and that governance piece was always core to MyFolio.
You mentioned where we've come from since 2010. And 5 years ago, we launched a MyFolio Index, which brought that passive capability, that tracking of index funds internally, thanks to the merger of Standard Life and Aberdeen. So we have real strength to be able to run much of that in-house.
Yeah.
That keeps costs low. So that's really beneficial. And then, as you say, in 2020, we launched Active MyFolio Sustainable because clients demand that now. I think it's really important. And
when you're actually managing a sustainable fund range, how is it that you actually go about defining and thinking about sustainability? Because I suppose it means different things to different people.
It certainly does, and that's a really good question. So one of the things to point out is we actually had, before the MyFolio Sustainable Fund ranges, a legacy product on the Aberdeen stable, which we've been running since 2005. It was actually the longest running ethical fund of funds anywhere in Europe. So when we were thinking around the sustainable MyFolio franchises back in 2020 and 2022, we already had a good head start in terms of the research, understanding of the type of managers that are out there and those different kind of shades of green, if you like. And that sustainability means different things to different people. There is no one answer, and it becomes quite a values-based decision for some investors. So that the way we think about and the way we have created the two MyFolio ranges, as we think about sustainability principally through the lens of we want to do more good and less harm. Yeah. So we're not badging the sustainable ranges as dark green, ethical or impact funds. We're very much appealing to the kind of center ground. So that we do that in quite a kind of methodical way, as you probably expect from the way we've run the portfolios for 14 years now. But we keep it actually quite simple to explain. So we call it ABCD. So A is avoiding harm. And we will exclude companies that fail to meet certain criteria. So for us, that is tobacco companies. We are not willing to support tobacco manufacturing. We block companies that are involved in the extraction of thermal coal. We also exclude any companies that are controversial weapon manufacturers or involved in the supply chain of those weapons. And then finally, any company that fails what is called the UN Global Compact. So that is for the United Nations Compact. It's talking principally around kind of labor practices, around management kind of team. So if there's a company that fails on that, we will exclude those companies. So in total for Sustainable Index, that it's actually quite a big piece of work to actually monitor the funds every month to make sure that our underlying managers are sticking to those rules that we've imposed upon them. So first off, we avoid some of the nasties.
Yep.
Second off, on B, we back better companies. So we're actively trying, particularly in Sustainable Index, but also Sustainable Active, where we actually go out and find kind of genuine impact kind of managers who are out there trying to find the next kind of, I don't know, the next graphene manufacturer or the next green tech kind of company. Yeah. So that's in Sustainable Active. We actively tilt the portfolios towards those companies that are able to kind of do more good in the world. So we're trying to avoid the nasties, tilt the portfolio towards those companies that are doing good in the world. C is contribute to solutions. So we're actively trying to find these kind of impact strategies. So in our Sustainable Active range, we've got a manager, Sam Smart Materials. Those guys are out there trying to back businesses that are developing materials of the future and technologies of the future. So we've got an active sleeve that actually goes out to try and find those really interesting and novel type managers. And then really importantly for us on D, which is around governance. So D is our ABCD. The D piece is around ensuring that with the managers we have, we're tracking the way that they engage with their underlying company managers. Yeah. We track the voting records of our fund managers to make sure that they are holding management teams to account, and where there are examples of bad corporate governance or indeed gender diversity, all of these things, we are taking a keen interest in making sure that we are working with our underlying managers, that they are using their kind of responsible voice as the custodians of that capital. So in a nutshell, the sustainable ranges have all grown up around that philosophy. As Dan mentioned, literally this week, we just passed an important milestone on the sustainable index range crossing 100 million, which we hope makes it a bit more appealing to other fund buyers.
Yeah.
We'd like to see scale. Our sustainable active range is already over 100 million, and both of them are growing quite strongly. So it's an area that we're certainly looking to do more work on in the future.
Yeah, exciting as well. And it must be quite interesting, because going into that level of depth of detail, you know, with the ABCD approach and that additional diligence, that's something that's relatively, you know, it's newer for you as well, and it's something that you've seen with the industry changing as well. So
it's definitely something where we realised quite early, even though notwithstanding the fact we had a strategy that had been doing this for many years, the more Dan and I dug into it, the more we realised we had to learn.
Yeah.
So we hired an analyst, Sophie Meatyard, in 2020. And she's a dedicated ESG person, and she certainly keeps us both on the straight and narrow. She's very, very passionate about the subject. Yeah. But we actually have now in the broader multi-asset team a climate solutions group. And these guys also have been incredibly helpful when we think about, so we've got a regulatory change coming in the UK this year, SDR, Sustainable Disclosure Requirements.
Yeah, SDR is much easier to just nip out than that is, yeah.
So those rules and regulations are coming down the track at us all pretty soon. I think from your side of the fence, Fraser, it was going to mean that you're going to have to think about how you build sustainable kind of questions into your advice process and into the KYC for clients. From our side of the fence, It means that in order for our portfolios to keep their name sustainable, we will have to meet certain minimum standards.
Yeah.
We're very confident that our investment process is pretty thorough and probably meets 95% of them already.
Yeah.
But certainly the focus for the MyFolio team this year is going to be on ensuring we can fully comply with the new rules as they come in, which I think is going to be kind of end of this year, December, although there's still some uncertainty with the FCA about exactly what it's going to look like and when it's going to go live.
What does a typical day look like? You know, how would you, is there a, you know, I know maybe not to any 2 days are the same, but is there general themes that you see, or you know, how does a day in the life kind of run for you both?
Well, I think that's one of the best things about the role, actually, that it is so varied, and one of the things you have to embrace and appreciate very early in terms of being a risk taker or a named fund manager is that you will never learn enough about the markets. Nobody has ever said, I've done that, I've solved it, I know how markets work and what they're going to do. So you have to accept and be humble to the fact that you are always going to be learning. You're never going to be at a point where you say, I've finished that and I am the master at it. So look, what that means in terms of a day-to-day is that very rarely are 2 days exactly the same. Dan and I have got combinations of different projects going on at the moment. We've got a kind of, not rigid is the wrong word, a structured research and portfolio management kind of agenda that rolls through the week. So every Tuesday we meet up with our analyst team, discuss the managers they've met the week before, what meetings we've got coming up that week, what the results of those meetings were and whether it changes our view on any underlying fund. On a Wednesday is our portfolio management meeting where we gather all of the fund managers and all of the analysts together. So that's our kind of our main weekly investment forum where anything is on the table and on the agenda. And then every Friday, we spend a good 2 or 3 hours just the PMs running through and just casting our eye down the portfolios and keeping on sure that things are moving in the right direction. But outside of that, the research process and the research agenda is constantly evolving. We meet, I think we have 180 funds across active and passive on our buy list. And we're all else being equal trying to meet with the managers of those strategies at least twice per year. So you can see that across the 8 analysts and the 5 PMs, we're pretty active in terms of being out there.
That must be a...
No, sorry, Dan. I was going to say that's what I really like about the job. As an advisor, there's change. You'll know a bit about that.
Yeah.
Tax, legislation, whether it's from inheritance tax or ISA allowances. And I absolutely loved the fact that you never knew everything.
Yeah.
And you should never claim to know everything. So the fact that you're learning every day, I think, is really appealing.
Yeah.
And as Justin said, especially now with markets moving around so much and different opportunities, SDR, new fund opportunities to plug into those sustainable ranges we offer where appropriate. It's really very interesting, and we do feel really privileged to be able to have a job that just means we're learning stuff all the time. And importantly, we need to make sure the funds are running okay. And appropriately, so there's a lot of the day-to-day tasks are very important, and it's monitoring those funds, making sure they're adhering to their risk targets, making sure those funds, underlying funds we buy, are doing what they should. So yeah, that no day is the same, as you say, quite right.
Getting out and looking in the whites of people's eyes as well and having a conversation with them, and you know, just again, getting that insight and update on what they're doing. I mean, that must just be fascinating as well. And actually, you know, just speaking with people and interacting on such a range of different topics and conversations as well.
Yeah, we're very lucky. We get to speak to the best people in the industry. We try and find the best European fund manager or the best US fund manager and teams. And the fact that so much is now done on video means you can talk to anyone in the world.
Yeah.
And so we really benefit from speaking with a lot of very clever people, and we do the best we can to interpret that and apply it appropriately to the funds.
Justin, it'd be really valuable. I think our listeners, both on the advisor side and the client side, would find it really interesting, you know, just in terms of that outlook piece, where you, how you see you guys positioning things going forward, and how you see yourself reacting to market conditions.
We're very fortunate, again, in terms of the broader business, to have a great resource in terms of our global macro and research team. And we spend a lot of time with Paul Diggle, Luke, And the guys, they sit just around the corner from us in London. So it's great to have that kind of link into kind of properly academic economist thinking of the world, as well as what we hear from our managers. But I think what we'd say is that, so taking a step back, it's certainly clear to us that the markets have had a lot to digest over the past year or so. We could point to continued worries over interest rates, over inflation reaching generational highs. We've got wars in the Middle East. We've got problems with shipping. There's all sorts of things that the market can worry about right now. And what we've actually seen is the markets, they can call it the wall of worry. So the markets climb a wall of worry. And I think more latterly, we've certainly seen more positive sentiment from investors. And that really kicked off or pivoted in the fourth quarter of last year. And the markets at that point have started to become more confident that we have indeed seen now the peak of interest rates in this cycle. And the market starts to now look forward to cuts in interest rates across developed markets. And we think then our economic team has actually been quite constant on this, that we probably see that a bit later than people are thinking. But from June or July onwards, we start to see interest rates coming back down. And that said, I mean, even accounting for bumps in the road, the economic team's view is that inflation should also continue to slow towards target. And it's that kind of inflation retreat that allows monetary policy, well, interest rates maybe to move a bit lower than the people are currently thinking about at the moment. So in terms of growth, I mean, we in the UK have been kind of bumping along the bottom, and that's very similar to the European economies as well. I mean, technically, the UK may have been in a recession at the end of last year. It will be the shallowest recession we've seen for a generation. That's very similar pattern to what we see in the likes of Germany and France. We do think that actually from here, we start to see growth reaccelerate over the second half of this year. And obviously, the emerging markets, we're still very much focused on what's happening there, particularly in China, where we're keeping a close watch on things right now.
And with regards to interest rates and inflation in particular, what is it that our clients will see and feel on a day-to-day basis that really relates to that, that they would be able to resonate with personally?
Yeah, so I guess in the UK, we are very much focused around the cost of capital in terms of mortgages, and that kind of wealth effect. In the US, the wealth effect is linked more to the experience of stock markets. In the UK, it's very much linked to housing. So what we have seen in this cycle, maybe not quite as bad as some of the initial forecasts were in terms of how the rise in interest rates, again, against a very narrow period of time. And we have to take a step back and say interest rates increased from very low levels to the highest level in 40 years. And the pace of that adjustment was very, very shallow. In other words, the interest rates really went up very quickly. We haven't quite seen as bad an impact as many feared, and maybe that's down to the degree to which the UK mortgage industry is now much more on a fixed rate deals, and as those kind of maturities come through. So I guess going back to your question, where do we see it first? We probably see it first in that kind of personal consumption side of things, where people might have a bit more money back in their pocket. And obviously the converse of that is the savers won't be getting as much either. But
yeah, I think it would be foolish of me, not with the talent in the room just now, with the information you have available, and obviously what our clients would be interested, you know, is on, no one has that crystal ball, but you do have that forward-looking approach. Have you got any thoughts on the sort of outlook over the next 12 months, 24 months, longer term?
If we look back at what has happened, there's been a lot to digest. Rate worries over rate cycles, inflation, slowing growth, geopolitics, these all present challenges, of course. And we've seen markets almost ignore some of that and continue to do really well. And indeed, in Q4, the market became even more confident. And we hope we've seen probably the peak in rate rises now. I suppose today, the pickup in inflation has revived those concerns in some places. And the last mile might be difficult as central banks try to lower rates. But even allowing for those bumps, our economic team view is that inflation should continue to slow now. That means monetary policy should ease, rates can come down, and I think the portfolios are really well positioned for that.
Yeah. we're in quite a privileged position at Aberdeen Financial Planning because of that accessibility we have to you guys, being able to speak with you, you know, if there's direct client queries coming in, you know, being able to just have that relationship, have you here in the room today, you know, it's invaluable for us, but then by extension also our clients as well, and the information that they can receive as well. So Justin, Dan, I really just want to take the time to thank you both again for being here today. Like I say, it's a wet and cold and miserable day here in Edinburgh, so I really appreciate the journey all the more. But thanks again, gents. I really appreciate you making the effort.
Thanks.
Pleasure. Thank you.
If you want to find out more about the topics that we've discussed, hear more from either Justin or Dan, in the first instance, I would always encourage you to contact your financial planner. However, we would always welcome any correspondence directly here at Wealthwise, as always. We'd love to hear from you. If you've got any questions or comments, you can drop us an email at wealthwise@abrdn.com. Wealthwise is available on all usual podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, and wherever you access these from. Please do like and subscribe, with any and all feedback welcome. Join us next time on Wealthwise when we're going to be rejoined by Senior Financial Planner Keith Dunsmuir, as well as Scotland's Financial Planning Director Gavin Park, to continue our discussion on the UK's national obsession with property versus investing. Justin, Dan, thanks again, and thanks for listening.
This podcast is provided for general information only and assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets. It is provided for information purposes only and should not be considered as an offer, investment, recommendation, or solicitation to deal in any of the investments or products mentioned herein, and does not constitute investment research. The views in this podcast are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily reflect those of Aberdeen. The value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, and investors may get back less than the amount invested. Past performance is not a guide to future returns, return projections, or estimates, and provide no guarantee of future results.